Today's presenter is Michael Patton. Michael's a team lead for Webster Message Broker, Level 2 Support. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Michael.
Good morning. How is everybody this morning? Lines are muted. My fault. My name is Michael Patton. I am the team lead for Webster Message Broker Level 2 Support. Webster Message Broker is a complex application that has been called the Universal Translator. Configuring and programming it can be a daunting task. This session will discuss some methods for programming to debug both syntax and logic on message flows and sets, with an emphasis on the programmer's code. So let's take a look at it right now. The situation is that you're relatively new to the WebSphere Message Broker. You have only a little bit of working knowledge of the product, and you can handle yourself rather nicely where it concerns programming in any language like C++ or Java. You have been hired on in a small business, and they want you to build an enterprise system of flows and message sets to handle a business's workload. This system is to use HTTP, JMS, MQ series, mapping nodes, Java nodes, databases, and just to make things fun, we're going to throw in some aggregation too. Wow. Where do we start? Where in the world do we start? Well, we start with our goal. You have to define your goal and what is the end result of that, what you need to accomplish. Sure, you could say that the goal is to make an enterprise system that will accomplish this and do that. In fact, the goal is the easy part. Goal has pretty much been defined to you by your boss when this task was assigned to you. Now you take this goal and you can break it down into smaller pieces or interim objectives. Go back to your college days where you learned about object-oriented design. You can apply this OOD to the upcoming Message Broker Enterprise system just like you can when you were programming in C++ or Java. Message brokers can do that too. One of the best features of C++ and Java is its ability for code reuse, and yes, the Message Broker can reuse code as well. The title of this presentation is Troubleshooting the WebSphere Message Broker Flows and Sets, a Programmer's View. The aim of this presentation is to discuss how you, the programmer, can set up a defensive broker and assist you with debugging. I will emphasize that the goal is not a step-by-step instruction on how to administer your broker or to troubleshoot configuration issues. There have been plenty of other presentations that discuss troubleshooting from an administrator's perspective. I'm going to make an assumption here that you already know how to or know someone who can create and administer the broker. Making a short stop to take a look at our agenda, I'll go over the three main ideas with respect to troubleshooting from a programmer's perspective. The first topic is the kinds of errors. Just like it says, we will discuss the kinds of errors that you may encounter when programming. And the second topic is tools to catch errors. Here we're going to go over some tools that we can use to help figure out ways to fix some of these errors. And lastly, we're going to be talking about preventatives, ways that you can be proactive in your coding. There are two kinds of errors that you will experience when programming, syntactical and logical. A syntactical error is simply an error that occurs when a program cannot understand the command that has been entered. And the second is a logical error. Simply put, logical errors program due to an incorrect sequence of instructions. There is a difference between the two. Have you ever entered a command to your computer and had it return something along the lines that it simply did not understand what you typed? I think just about every one of us has. Some examples of syntax error would be a typo on the command line, an invalid flag or switch, or the command simply does not exist. There are some syntax errors you would see on the command line, but since we're concentrating on the message broker, what about syntax errors in the toolkit? The same principle applies. You could have an ESQL or a property that you're finding has a typo, or the instruction that you coded is not valid for a flag or a parameter error. Looking at the sample that I have on the screen now, there are three syntactical errors. Notice in the left gutter that there are red X's clearly indicating that something is amiss. A toolkit, this toolkit in particular, is your first line of defense, standing guard against syntax errors. It will insert that red X on the screen and let you know that there is a problem. If you click your mouse over the X, it will highlight the syntax it does not like. You can also look at the problem tab view, and it will give you a list of the syntax errors that you will need to correct. I remember in my early programming days, the toolkits were usually not quite this smart. I actually had to attempt to compile my C programs and have the compiler alert me as to what was wrong. This usually led me to run the compile command many, many times as I was working, just to keep up with the syntax errors. The toolkit is smart enough to let you know about the syntax errors before you add the flows to the bar file and deploy. And syntax errors are generally thought to be the easy part. Correct the typo, or the parameter list, or the function call, and all is well. Next, we have logical errors. These are a different kind of beast. There is an old saying that programs will do exactly what you tell them to. This is a very true statement. They will do exactly what you tell them to, so long as you tell them exactly what you want them to do in a way that they understand. A logical error has all the correct syntax, but it simply will not do what you want it to. Do you have a 5-year-old? If you do, or have you ever had one or know of one, then you know what I speak is true. Let me put out my own boy, for example. If I had asked him to pick up his toys and he said yes, I only find out that later, yes, he picked them up, but then he tossed them somewhere else. Not quite exactly what I expected, since my desire was to have him put his toys away in a toy chest. Since I did not tell him where I wanted him to put them down, he chose his own place, and that was piled up in the corner. The broker, and all the programming for that matter, acts the same way. You have to tell it exactly what you want it to do. Since logical errors are not marked or flagged or highlighted in any way, they are inherently difficult to flush out. The syntax errors have been corrected, and I have made a small change to the SQL, so now it has a logical error in it. Notice that there are no red X's in the gutter. Can you find it? I know the phones are on mute, so I'm not really expecting an answer, but if you just took a look at that, it may be difficult to find it. It may not, but it may simply because I've not indicated what the desired results are. But we can deduce that since we are copying the input route to the output route, we're more than likely planning on passing this message along. The logical error on this slide is the return false statement. The value of the false will not propagate the message to a tree to an output terminal. Granted, this logical error is a bit simplistic, but I just wanted to point out that logical errors are not flagged by the toolkit simply because there is nothing syntactically wrong with the return false statement. It is a perfectly good statement. Logical errors are usually more devious than this one, though. Please note, though, that logical errors will compile into a bar file just fine and deploy without errors. The logical error will lie in ambush, waiting for just the right set of circumstances to come along and pounce. You will not know it has pounced when the flow does not do what you wanted it or expected it to do. Oftentimes, the data flow engine or execution group will fail and just toss an exception, enter a loop forcing you to issue immediate shutdown to get out of it, or in the mild cases, just give you that output. Let's discuss some ways that we can catch some of these. When debugging your message flow and message sets, it is often quite helpful to have at your disposal tools that will assist in this endeavor. My favorite tool is the RFH utility and user trace. I'll go over the user trace first and then the visual debugger, and then finally some external tools and support packs that will help you in your debugging effort. The user trace is a very powerful tool that we have at our disposal. I would even say it is even more powerful than the visual debugger, only because the user trace has the capability to move backwards as well as forwards when following what the message broker is doing to your data and the results of the commands that were issued. A key component in user trace is the trace node, and the trace node will force a complete parse of your message according to the trace pattern entered, the most common pattern being dollar open bracket root close bracket. This is beneficial because you can see the message tree at specific points in your flow. This is more important, in my opinion, than the visual debugger. It is true that the visual debugger can show you all these things as well, but you have to be in interactive session with the message flow, and there is no text record that you can use for analysis. Do not get me wrong. I like the visual debugger as much as the next guy, and it does have its benefits. I just prefer the ability to move in two directions. I'll get to the benefits of the visual debugger in a bit. The administration portion of the user trace is primarily the command line. You can turn trace on and off with the MQSI change trace command, and you can process the trace with the MQSI read log and the MQSI format log commands. I would highly recommend that you make a batch or a script file that has these commands in it. It really does help speed things up. Now, when looking at some of the output from your user trace, you can spot all kinds of reasons why something failed. First, there are ODBC errors, which are kind of easy to spot, actually. These are usually marked with some type of indication, like a database exception. Remaining details in the message will provide information, like the SQL state, the native error code, or some text as to what is wrong. Looking at this particular screen that we have here, it says database error, SQL state 08001, native error code, and error text, and it's giving a whole bunch of stuff in the SQL state. And it might even have some text in there. Sometimes the database error requires further investigation into the database itself, but that would be an administrative task, not a programming task. For the purposes of this presentation, I will maintain that the connection to the database is good. Now, notwithstanding the connection, we could possibly see results that's coming back from the database that are not what we would expect. The result set could be incorrect. There could be no result set. Back to what I said earlier. A computer will do exactly what you tell it to. So let's investigate any SQL commands that you're issuing. To debug your SQL commands, the first thing to do is to run the command outside the broker. Using whatever SQL interface that your database provides, connect to the database in question and run the exact same SQL command that the broker would have otherwise been running. Check the results given there. Are the same results that the broker received? Yes. Then the SQL command passed through to the database, came back good. The error is then in the SQL command. And if the results are not the same, then there is an issue with the ODBC drivers. The SQL prepare is probably not working correctly, and at this point, a call to IBM support is in order to fix those drivers. The second common error that you can find in user trace is the parsing error. Many times, it will come up with a failure to navigate. A failure to navigate some element and some number is given. Looking at the preceding message and the structure that it is looking for. If we find the element that it failed to navigate to, then it's simply a matter of counting over from the start of the command line. Looking at this slide, we see that we are attempting to set an output field to be equal to the value of the input field in EverNeverland. We can see that the error is telling us that it cannot locate element number 4. However, EverNeverland doesn't exist. So we get our failure to navigate message. We will need to alter our ESQL to navigate to a field that does exist, or alter our input to include that field. Please note, though, that not all failure to navigate messages are necessarily a bad thing. The failure to navigate will also come up when checking for the existence of an element, and a failure to navigate simply means that the element did not exist. That could be the desired result, especially if your logic is dependent on the existence or non-existence of an element. Let's take a moment to consider the message set. Message set is simply a method to predefine the metadata of a message. By comparison to XML documents, it is the XSD or XML schema of a message that can be used to validate the content and structure of a message. Many XML GUIs offer the ability to check the validity of a message. This is not to be confused with checking the well-formedness of a message, as a well-formed XML simply means that the syntax is correct. The validity of a message is checked by comparing the structure and content to determine if the message tree is presented according to specifications, but also that the content of the elements are of the same data types as per specifications. You could end up with a message that is looking for an integer as a data type and have it presented with alpha characters. This would then fail validation, even if the well-formedness of the XML was good. When using the trace node with the messages and message sets, it does have an advantage because the trace node will show you the message. It will also show you the type constant that is associated with the element in question. If you search in the toolkit for XML and MRM parser constants, you will find all of the constants that define types. You can then ascertain if your message is being built with the correct types as well. If the constants do not seem to match, you can be sure that the message tree still is quite not right. Thirdly, and this is actually quite a common error, is that the message tree is built out of order. The order is very important. The message you will see is invalid message body header sequence, and it'll give some type MRM, MQRF, H2 is encountered by the node. The name of the node that found it. The usual reason for this is that the tree indeed was built out of order. Just as a matter of course, the order for headers is properties, MQMD, any other header than the body. The body must always be the last child of the root. So how does the message tree get built out of order? The usual suspect is the compute node. Ah, the ubiquitous compute node strikes again. The compute node is a very, very powerful node indeed. It is the guts of a message transformation in the broker. The compute node has two sides, the input side and the output side. You, the programmer, need to make sure that the two sides are mapped correctly. The compute node comes equipped with two procedures, as a matter of course. They are the copy entire message procedure and the copy message headers procedure. The copy entire message procedure will perform a pointer copy only and pass along the entire message to the output side of things without performing any transforms. Once on the output side of things, you can manipulate the message with respect to the output root tree. This has the benefit of ensuring that the entire message is passed and the headers are kept in the same order as the input tree presented. Where folks tend to get in trouble with the header order is that if they decide to add a new header, after the root copy is performed, they issue a statement such as set output root.mqrf h2.something.something. What happens is that the broker will add this header after the message body, as the default action is to add any elements as the last child of the parent element if the element does not exist. Thus, if your tree looked like root.properties, then root.mqmd, then root.xmlnsc, and you issue a set statement for the mqrfh2, then the last child of the root would then be the rmqrfh2 header, and we just can't have that. So how do you fix that error? Well, if you know the order of headers, then you can use the create statement. So based on the same example, and you wanted to add the mqrfh2 header, you would enter the statement create next sibling of output root.mqmd domain mqrfh2. By issuing the create statement, it is actually telling you where in the message tree you wanted to insert the new element that you're creating. In this case, it's going to be your mqrfh2 header. And by giving it a domain association, you're also telling it what parser to use for it. Please ensure, though, that whenever you're going to issue a next sibling of the MQMD, that the MQMD header does actually exist. Because if the next sibling of what you're trying to issue does not exist, then once again, the field or the parser or the domain or the header that you're trying to create will go to the last child of the output root again. Finally, you can also spot in user trace queue manager errors. These are usually marked with a bit 2600 message. The MQ output node did something and is followed with some very handy MQRC codes. The MQRC codes are usually quite nice about telling you exactly why it did not like the last bit of activity. As you can see in this slide, the MQRC 2053 is telling you that the queue that I tried to write to was full. MQ Series has made available a command that you can use to look up any response code that it issues. It is called MQRC, which is short for MQ return code. You can use it to look up all kinds of MQ codes, even AMQ codes that you may see. Other QM errors you may have to investigate through MQ Series itself. This will involve looking at the QM logs, FDC files, and that the MQ Series generates. Now, most of these same items can also be determined in the visual debugger as well. The key difference is that you, for me, is that you cannot go backwards in the visual debugger. The biggest feature of the visual debugger, though, is an ability to monitor the flows in real time to see what they are doing. This slide is showing the state of, or actually a small snippet of, the state of the message tree. Here we can see the HTTP header information for a message. This state was taken out of a sample project, and this sample project will be included on this presentation site later. I like the visual debugger because it does allow me to walk through the message flow and with activating breakpoints at a specific target. I can get right to the point I wish to inspect rather quickly by use of those breakpoints. I can, if I would like to mention that there is a big difference between version 5.0 and 6.0 visual debuggers as compared with version 6.1 visual debuggers. On version 5 and 6, the visual debugger connects to the broker via the remote agent controller. This is a separate component that needs to be configured in order to work properly. Version 6.1 now uses the Java debugger port instead, thus eliminating the need for a separate component. By using the Java debugging port, the toolkit, which is Java-based, fits quite nicely to the task. But back to the visual debugger in general. In either case, you have the ability to see the message as it is flowing through, and you have the added bonus of being able to alter the data in midstream through the debugger. This allows you to fix or break, as you would have it, the message along the way to test your code. Other than that, not much really more to say about the visual debugger. Some external tools that we have. Along the side of standard debugging tools with Message Broker, there are many other tools that are available, both from IBM and some that are not, but are worth mentioning. The first is the RFH util. That is support pack IH03. This is by far a quite powerful tool that is used to submit test messages to a queue. I believe it is a better tool for the toolkit's put message functionality. One reason for this is that it may be kind of silly, but it is still my opinion, is that with all of the windows that I could have open in my toolkit, having an NQ file open as well just adds to the clutter. The RFH utility has some features in it that allow me to look at the message both as input and output and in various number of ways. I can see this message as text or as hex. I can parse it in XML. I can change it between ASCII and EBCDIC. And I can also do things with it in what I like to call hex text. It's kind of looking at the characters, it's looking at the hex values, but it's actually an ASCII. It's a limitation that is purely a Windows application, but all is not lost. RFH utility also has a client flavor so that it can connect to a queue manager on any other platform. The second is QLoad. QLoad is support pack MO03, and this tool allows for the rapid loading and unloading of multiple messages from a queue. In addition, it allows you to capture the entire message from a queue, headers and all, and save them to a file. While similar to RFH util, it has the capability for multiple message handling, but it lacks visual interface, as it is a command line tool. QLoad works well on Unix platforms, since RFH util is a Windows application. And finally, for HTTP, and this has always been a sticking point for many folks working with HTTP flows, is a tool that can help issue MQ puts and gets to help test the HTTP nodes of the flow. That tool is not an IBM product, but it is available on the internet, and it is a simple tool for putting and getting messages via the HTTP protocol. To find it, simply Google the name. I like this tool mainly because it contains both an HTTP client and an HTTP tunneling feature. The client feature is nice for the ability to put and get messages via HTTP. And the tunneling feature is especially attractive for the fact that I can intercept messages between the broker and its targeted web service, and I can see exactly the message that is being passed on the stream outside of the broker, much like you can with RFH utility to see what the message broker has output. Wouldn't it be nice if we could write code and it ran perfectly the first time? No bugs. No need to figure out what happened. No need for any exception handling. Returning to Earth, that is not usually how coding works. The same applies to flows. So let's turn our attention to what we can do as a precaution to assist us in debugging. As with many programming tasks, we add exception handling to the code. Just like recursion, we build in small workable pieces and test them until the crows come home. And finally, we can take those small pieces and place them in a library for reuse, knowing that they have been tested and found to be true. In Java and C++, there's a concept of a try-catch block. In a try-catch block, there is a wrapper around a block of code that will trap an error in processing and attempt to do something with it. This is mainly to prevent the application from crashing to a halt. If you make judicial uses of the try-catch block, you can not only stop catastrophic errors from causing a crash, you can also use the catch block to report what happened so you can figure out how to fix it. The message broker provides two ways to capture exceptions. One is with the nodes, and the other is with ESQL. The most obvious exception catching node is the try-catch node. What this node does is send the input message out to the try terminal unaltered. If all goes well downstream, then no worries. However, if an exception is tossed, then the broker will back out the message to the closest try-catch node, and if that is the try-catch node, then the try-catch node will intercept the broker's passing back of the message and send it forward down the catch output terminal. This is similar to what a C++ or a Java program does when catching an exception. The not-quite-so-obvious try-catch node is installed in every flow input type node. This includes the MQ input node, the JMS input node, the HTTP input node. It does not include the general input node, as the general input node is used for starting subflows. Take a look at any one of these input nodes, and you will see that it has an output terminal labeled catch. On the screen, we have an input node. There is only one output terminal. That is the general input node. We can also see on this subflow that I have on the screen that you may be able to discern that it is an exception handler subflow. Or not, but take my word for it, it is. There is no MQ input node, so it cannot be a flow in and out of itself. Therefore, it can only be added to another flow. What this subflow does is simply make a log entry of the error that was captured. I'm going to see a little bit more because we're going to dig into that store message in database compute node in a minute. But this subflow is fed by a catch terminal of a try-catch type node in the parent flow, that either being a try-catch node or an input type node. So we've got our subflow. Let's take a look in ESQL. The second type of exception handler is, oddly enough, called the handler. Do not let the name fool you. It is a catch code. The big difference here is that in WMV version 6, IBM introduced the ability to catch exceptions in the compute node and handle them directly without having to pass the message backwards in the flow. In order to use the handler code, all handler code must be at the top of the scope before any other statements. The SQL states values provided in the declare handler statements can be compared directly with the SQL state of the exception or be compared using wildcard characters. To compare the state values directly, specify either value or condition operator. To make a wildcard comparison, use the underscore and the percent characters to represent single and multiple character cards, respectively, and specify the like operator. All this is very similar to, regular expressions. Sort of like regular expressions, but the wildcards with the asterisks. The wildcard method does allow all exceptions of a general type to be handled without having to list them exhaustively. It's kind of like a catch-all. It is interesting to note that the handlers can contain handlers to capture exceptions tossed by the handler itself. Wow. To summarize the handler, they absorb exceptions, thus preventing the message from backing out, thus allowing the transaction to be committed rather than rolled back. So we've now looked at two different types of exception capturing. We've looked at the handler, and we've also looked at the subflow for exception handling. Moving on in preventatives, looking at some component testing. As with all good programming, it is essential to test. And when you're done, test again. And when you've done all the testing you can, test some more. That is how it should be, and all the applications would be released error-free? Perhaps. The only bug-free code I have ever seen is Hello World. So how do we test? Well, remember in basic programming class where recursion was discussed? Thinking not so much on the actual recursion itself, but the point that was made about recursion was breaking down the problem to its smallest components. Why not apply that same concept to your flow design? When opening this presentation, I mentioned to you that a fairly new flow designer was just tasked with designing and building your company's enterprise system to handle all the workload. Let's put a title on it. You are designing the company's travel office. Your system will accept input from MQ Series. The flow will then take the message, a travel request form if you like, and seek out the rates and details for an employee to fly to his destination, rent a car while there, and have a place to sleep while there as well, then get back home. The interface to this airline information is accomplished through a web service. The car rental company wants to respond requests via MQ, and the hotel wants to communicate over the telephone. Well, somebody has to get on the phone and call. Once the data is returned, the responses need to be collated and submitted to an accounting and management for approval. Then and only then will the employee get a response back to as to whether or not he can go. This does sound a lot like one of the samples in the toolkit. Mostly it is, but I embellished on it to make a point about components. The sample I'm referring to is the aggregation sample. I added to this sample by including message sets, multiple format changes, and multiple communication methods. Again, I will make this project available on this website. To illustrate the componentization, all the flows were broken down into small pieces. I have a flow that handles just the input request from the employee. I have another flow that handles only the airline request, and another flow that only handles the car rental, and yet another flow as added that handles only the hotel, and another flow that puts them all back together again. And then there's a separate flow that handles the accounting and another one for the management approval. In each one of these flows, the message is different. In some cases, I knew what the message was going to look like before it arrived. Other times, I did not, and I did have to rely on the MQRFH2 header.
What?
The MQRFH2 header is not normally included. I added the header where necessary. Oh, I would lose the MQMD header when the message was passed through an HTTP request node. Had to find a way to keep that header and restore it later.
Uh-oh.
Message did not parse right? Where did the message get garbled? I got my message out as a blob instead of an XML document. Where did my format go? All these problems would have been a nightmare to figure out if I had coded the entire enterprise system, deployed it, and hoped it worked. Instead, each flow was coded and tested. The airport message flow coded and tested to see that it worked, and then I would get the desired output. Then the test included running messages through that I knew would fail. Did they? Did my exception handlers catch failures and give a good report as to why there was a failure? The flows were built in small pieces and put together after they were built. Think of a builder constructing your home. Does he come in with a house already built and just slap it down on the ground and say, here you go? No, of course not. He comes in and builds it piece by piece, brick by brick. He puts together a whole bunch of smaller blocks to build your home. We can do the same thing with flows. Which brings us to libraries. After you've done so much testing and retesting and building of some building blocks, wouldn't it be nice to be able to reuse them in many different places? Exception handling subflows are a good target for reuse. You can create one subflow and insert it throughout the flow, or even use it in other flows, or for that matter, other projects. The opportunities are boundless. You can see in here, I've got my exception handler subflow already listed. I created another library flow as a web service provider as well. We can see a little bit down, I also have a common ESQL, which is part of my library. Not only can you reuse subflows, you can reuse ESQL as well. The slide here shows an ESQL that can be used anywhere. Well, this one in particular is this project anyway, but it can be reused in many locations throughout the project. This allowed me to code this function once and call it from several locations in the flow. Note that the library code like this needs to have its value passed into it by reference. They do not maintain the default root structure like you find in the compute modules. And if you do not pass the data in by reference, any changes made to the structure are lost once the library code is out of spec. This is just like C++ or Java. Alrighty then, this brings us to the conclusion of this presentation. To summarize, I hope I have presented you with several thoughts on some tools you can use for debugging your flows. Tools such as user trace, trace notes, visual debuggers, RFA's util, QLoad, and NetTool. I also hope that I've shown you some ideas on how to prevent errors from occurring in the first place and how to handle them when they do. I would ask that you try some of these ideas out. I have the travel agency projects for disbursement if you would like to take a look at some of the components and exception handling routines for yourself. All the concepts are in the toolkit sample pages, but not all put together in one project like this. I believe you will find that if you use the tools and ideas presented, you will have a faster design to deploy time in your message projects. Thank you.
At this time, we'll conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation. We hope you will join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the Western Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, a replay of today's presentation will also be available on the site in the next day or two. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Michael, for presenting today.